are Harvard Ventures, and this is The Bottom Line, a podcast about entrepreneurship, innovation, and everything in between. I'm Virginia, and today we have special guest Rob Capito in the studio. Mr. Capito is the president and co-founder of BlackRock, the largest asset manager in the world, with $8.7 trillion in assets under management. He is responsible for the day-to-day oversight of BlackRock's key operating units, including investment strategies, client businesses, technology and operations, and risk and quantitative analysis. Mr. Capito is also director of iShares, Inc., a gathering of ETFs or exchange-traded funds, which comprises of $2.7 trillion of BlackRock's assets. Mr. Capito earned a BS degree in economics from the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania and holds an MBA degree from Harvard Business School. Let's get right into the bottom line.
So as a co-founder of the largest asset manager in the world, can you share your path as an entrepreneur with our listeners? And did you always want to start your own firm?
So I wouldn't consider myself an entrepreneur. I started having many, many jobs in the past. And coming out of school, I was fortunate enough to get a two-year analyst position at an investment bank called First Boston, which is now Credit Suisse. And I worked for 2 years in the tax-exempt area. And I tried to immerse myself in understanding what was going on in Wall Street. I had an interest in money, and I wanted to see how it all worked. And during my two-year period, I didn't just stay in one area. I always walked around to try to see what people were doing because I had known that I was going to go back to business school. So this was an opportunity for me to see different areas. And I found myself always gravitating to the sales and trading floor and meeting people there and was very interested in what they were doing. And then I went back to a business school, of course, Harvard Business School, which I was so happy to get into. I still don't know how. And while I was there, I took a summer job in consulting and I worked for a Bain & Company. And I really, you know, wanted to see why people thought consulting was so good. And I had an incredible experience and really enjoyed it. Now I had to make a decision where I was going to end up as a full-time job when I graduated. And I really thought that I was going to stay in consulting because I really liked the people and I liked what they were doing. It was exciting. But I was sitting, instead of doing one of my cases one night, I was thumbing through an MBA catalog and I saw an ad for McKinsey. And it was a guy standing next to the chairman of the board, sort of telling him what to do. That was what the picture looked like. And then I thumbed a few pages later and there was an ad for Smith Barney. And it was a guy standing on the sales and trading floor with two phones and lots of screens and lots of activity. And I closed the book and I went in to the kitchen and my wife was there. And I said, you know what, we could live in Boston and be very happy working for Bain, great company. But this is really not my true personality. And I showed her the picture of Smith Barney. And I said, this is really who I think I am, not the other guy. And so I told Bain that I was not going to come. And I drove to New York. And I started working on the sales and trading floor for First Boston. And the person that I sat next to was a guy named Larry Fink, who I've now been partners with for 36 years. So I guess the moral of the story is you may have a vision as to what you want to do, but you're going to succeed more where you can really show your true personality and work with people that have similar standards and personalities. So working at First Boston for many years, we had an idea. And the idea was we thought of a way that we can enhance the ability for clients to be able to get good returns with good risks. And that is when that idea turned into an entrepreneurial opportunity. So it was only after one, getting in touch with your true personality, working with people that had the same morals and values, learning some content, so you actually had something that you can offer, and then thinking about how you could disintermediate and disrupt a business in a way that would make room for a new business. So it didn't start off as an entrepreneur. And in hindsight, maybe it looks that way, but it was really doing those three steps before an idea was available to take advantage of.
That's a remarkable story, Mr. Capito. And I find it really interesting that you originally didn't consider yourself an entrepreneur and then brought this idea to life and has, you know, you've executed more than any other asset management fund in the world. So over the past 32 years, what stands out as some of the make or break moments? And in hindsight, why do you think you were so successful in building the world's largest asset management firm?
Well, one is obviously having a different way to solve a problem, but one certainly is bringing technology to a market that didn't necessarily have technology at that point and developing that technology. But the most important thing was keeping our promise to our clients. So what we said that we were going to do, we actually did. And the most difficult times come in the very beginning, where you're working with a group of people who all have a common vision, but may want to do things in a very different way. So it's really getting to know your team, building the trust in that particular team, complementing each other and not competing with each other, and then coming up with an idea that you actually have to execute. It has to work, and it has to work for the long term. So there was never any desire to come in, have an idea, take it public, make a lot of money, and then move on. This was to build something that would last well beyond all of the founding partners. So it was a longer term vision of being able to get close to clients so that we knew how to solve their problems and then actually solve the problems. Because if you keep your promise to your clients, they'll actually want to do more with you. So innovation is constant. You have to constantly be ahead of where you think the market is going to go and where the clients are going to go. And you have to continue to innovate. Even after 32 years, we're still continuing to innovate. But the reason for the growth is simply that we've kept our promises.
So is there anything you would do differently if you were starting BlackRock today compared to 1988?
Well, you know, I get asked that a lot. And the first thing is about the team. And we were fortunate enough to understand what it would take to build this and then bring in those people. So the founding partners, and there were eight, to tell you how successful those people were in working together and building something special together. If I were to start BlackRock again today, I would take the same eight people to start the firm today. It was something that's very unusual. We all gelled. We had a common vision. We didn't compete with each other. It was the equivalent of no one knowing how to swim and you're thrown in a pool. You got to embrace each other and figure out how to get out of the pool and swim. And we all did it. And we did it in a way with high integrity. All of us today, we're not all still at the firm today, but over the first 20 years we were. All of us have long-term marriages and big families. So how did we do that? Because we covered each other. We had respect for each other. We helped each other to be successful, but we all followed a common vision and we all had a common mission. And everybody contributed in slightly different ways, and we're all still very close and good friends today, even though some of them have gone on to do other things.
I love what you said in terms of, you know, if you were to do it again, you do it again with the same 8 people, because if you start a company and your first co-founder is your first hire, that's half of your company. So that's incredibly important.
Well, it says a lot about, picking the people, right? So some people, you meet somebody, but do you really know them? And, you know, people are different when things are going well than when things are not going well. So it's a very similar thing, Virginia, to the beginning question that you asked me about understanding your personality and the personalities of the people with you. But you all have to understand the mission, and then you have to understand your role in the mission. And then you also have to make sure that you complement each other, and you're not looking to compete or get credit for one versus another. And that is not an easy thing to do. As you see, most entrepreneurs that are successful are very personable, loud. They have their vision, and it's their vision, and they don't want to let other people in. And, you know, partners are hard. And so that was really the secret sauce for our success, but it may not be the secret sauce for, you know, other businesses.
Absolutely. I agree completely. And I think that's a perfect reiteration for Harvard students specifically, because it's a very competitive environment where people need to work together to achieve these things. So you studied economics at Wharton and you have a Harvard MBA. Was there a class or a professor that made a significant impact on you as an entrepreneur and leader?
Oh, absolutely. There was a professor, Ted Lowe, who was the marketing professor at Harvard Business School. And he taught us about organizational behavior and marketing. And those skills have come to me daily, of learning how to get people to march in the same direction. You have many different types of personalities, and trying to get the best out of A-type personalities is an art and a science. And so that was a very important class to me. And the second thing would be a class that was in capital markets, which really was a class that explained how the capital markets actually work and how money circulates and how businesses work. And those two, I would say, would be important classes that I remember taking that really made an impact on how I operate even today.
Well, now we'll really be sure to emphasize capital markets in our curriculum at Harvard Ventures. Thank you so much for answering my questions. I'm passing the rest of the questions to Jonathan.
Thanks, Virginia. For all the inspiring investors who are interested in founding their own firms one day, what advice would you give specifically on raising capital?
Well, you have to need the capital. So the first part that I think people make a mistake about is they have a hockey stick, and the hockey stick shows that when you're first gonna get revenues and when you are gonna cover your expenses. And more times than none, I find that the hockey stick, the bottom piece is much longer, and people run out of capital because they didn't raise enough and they didn't realize that things will take longer than expected. So it's not about raising capital, it's how much capital you need to raise, and also how much you're willing to give away to raise that capital, and is it a capital intensive business? But I can assure you it takes longer to get it started, It cost more than you would have anticipated that it's going to cost. And you want to have somebody that is willing to give you long-term capital to build a real business rather than someone that's looking for a very quick return. So your partners that give you money are very, very important that they understand what you're trying to do and sit there right next to you and are willing to continue to invest in you. And in order to do that, you need to keep your promises and make sure that you're on a time frame that's realistic and that the product's actually going to work, that you are innovating.
I think what you just said there is really important, and that as a founder, what you're looking for are people who are truly invested in your success and not just looking for a quick profit, but that are willing to invest their capital and time long term. Continuing with the topic of capital allocation, recently in one of the annual letters, BlackRock underscored its commitment to ESG investing. How has ESG shaped BlackRock's investment theses, and how do you balance sustainability with demand for fossil fuels, particularly with respect to a new president-elect?
Well, look, this is a very big issue. Are there ways that we can improve the world through investing? And the answer is yes. We all know that. And it comes through the different areas you may invest in. It comes through the different products. It comes through the different companies. It's raising the bar and putting your money behind raising that bar. But remember, it's not only a big country, it's a big world. And so you have to be careful what you wish for. And it's very difficult to turn off one thing and turn on another thing because a group of people believe that this is the way to go forward, because there may be a group of people that believe differently. And there are people that are employed by industries that you may have determined that you're going to turn off and cause major disruptions around the globe. You can't turn off all the electricity in the country because you decided that there's a new and cleaner method to do it. You have to move into it in a process that is positive. Different countries across the world only use coal. And so are we going to turn off everything, all of their energy usage, because you have decided in Boston that fossil fuels are a bad thing? So it's a process. And we're all learning that we need to have more of a purpose for our investments. And it's not just the return. It's also what you're investing in. What is the impact? How do we improve sustainability? How do we improve stewardship? How do we improve the environment? And then use our investments to help move that process along. And that's how we've looked at it at BlackRock. But you have to also understand the business that I'm in. It's not my money. So I could tell you that if somebody in Boston wants to divest of oil, the pension plan in Texas does not want to divest in oil. So what I have to do is create particular guidelines that the client wants us to manage their money and then be true to those particular guidelines because it's their money. However, if we can start to invest money and utilize sustainability as a variable to show that portfolios are moving in that direction, we may be able to start to move the needle because more and more clients would like to direct their money in that direction. And so that's what we're doing. We've developed products that pinpoint the specific needs and desires of our clients. And within a framework, we have added that variable of ESG into everyone's portfolio so that we can start to move the needle. But we all have to make an effort to do that. And you can't just turn off and turn on, because for as many good things, there are many bad things. but we can move it in that direction and move it quickly if that's the way the world wants to invest their money. And I can tell you that today we're moving the needle and we're making great progress. And more investors that are coming into the markets want to have their money make more of a positive impact on the world. And we're going to continue to guide that and to help make that happen.
ESG is definitely a complicated issue, but from what you said, it seems like there's a definite trend towards more and more people investing in ESG. Changing topics slightly, BlackRock is the largest sponsor of ETFs. Do you see any issues with passive investing as passive investors track an index without researching the fundamentals of each investment? Do you think passive investing causes inflated asset values and inefficiently allocates capital?
No, it's really not a great question, and I'll tell you why. Because there is room in a portfolio for both active and passive investments. So, for example, if you are investing in large cap equity growth products, there may not be a very big difference in the returns amongst various managers, and it may be very costly once you take out the fees and expenses in that. And therefore, you may want to describe that part of your portfolio in more of an index fashion. So if people aren't outperforming the benchmark for 10 years in a row, and you need to have an allocation, you may just want to do it in a very cheap way, but get that exposure. Then again, if you're in a small cap equity, where actually manager selection becomes even more important, and knowing the individual underlying stocks becomes more important and can differentiate you, that you may want to express more in an active way. But keep in mind, not only would you want to have both of those particular styles in your portfolio, but the movement now is to be active with your passive. So where you're making the money is not from the individual stocks, you're making it from your asset allocation. And in order to move quickly in an asset allocation, using ETFs is a most liquid, diversified, inexpensive way to use asset allocation as the biggest part of your returns. And that has been the big wave, which has really caused the dramatic growth in ETFs, as well as the cost. So that is one reason to describe growth in the ETF market. But in various markets, the bid offer spread and the cost to get into these can be rather large. And in the fixed income market, where interest rates are low and will probably be low for a long period of time, the cost to get in and out of those may take away almost all of your returns. So therefore, getting into fixed income in a much more diversified, liquid, cheaper way may be a better option to have exposure in the individual bond sector. So what I described to you is just reasons why you really need to have both, depending upon the area you want to invest, the time frame that you want to invest, and the type of manager you are, whether it be an individual bond or stock selector, or whether you're an asset allocation investor. So both are important.
That's a really interesting point you just made of being active in your passive asset allocation, as well as the benefits of having both active and passive investing in a portfolio. I wanted to talk about the Fed for a bit as well. Since the 2008-2009 financial crisis, the Fed has played a more prominent role in financial markets through quantitative easing, and its balance sheet has ballooned as a result. As a bit of background, at the height of the financial crisis, the Fed held $2 trillion in assets. Even before COVID hit, the Fed increased its assets held from $2 trillion to $4.5 trillion. In 2020, the assets held by the Fed rose to roughly $7.5 trillion. How do you go about navigating a market that increasingly seems Fed-driven?
Well, remember that there's a reason for each of those increases, and what was the alternative? So when the pandemic hit and we had to make sure that people had money because businesses were closing and people were going to become unemployed, what would you like the government to do? So, you know, putting money into the system to save the economy and to save the people is a really important thing to do. And now, over a period of time with quantitative easing, the Fed has been going out and borrowing and then buying securities in the marketplace. And that has kept interest rates low, which were very important to be able to operate in such a difficult environment. So I think the Fed and each of the crises that have come have acted in a very appropriate way. And there are a lot of people that at the time they act have lots of views, but at the end of the day, if you saw how well the economy has recovered, and yes, the balance sheet may be a little bit heavy now, but it's heavy for a reason because we've had an economic crisis or a health crisis that we have never seen before. So I think they've done an excellent job, and especially of bringing rates down now so that we can actually afford to keep the markets going. And at some point in time, obviously, that's going to change. And we're going to have to pay that money back. And that may come in the form of higher taxes. But the alternative at the time of that emergency was not that great. And so I applaud what the Fed has done to get us this to this point. And I think that working together, we will be able to get out of this. So I'm very optimistic. But I think the biggest issue we have is we have to get through this health crisis. And I've not lived through a health crisis like this before. I've lived through an economic crisis, a financial crisis. This is not going to be very easy to do, but you want to be around to be able to do it. So the most thing is the most important thing is getting through the COVID crisis. And then it'll be how the Fed steers us out of this, which I'm very optimistic we will be able to do.
So you just mentioned how optimistic you are about the future. On the flip side of that, what would you say keeps you up at night?
Well, what keeps me up at night is coming out of this as quickly as possible, because I see businesses, especially small businesses of people that I know right in New York City, and restaurants and others that people have put their entire life into them, and they've lost it. And it's going to be very difficult for them to come back without having capital. And it's going to take some time if they have the wherewithal to try to come back. And it worries me about the delay of getting the vaccines into the arms of people. And I can't for the life of me seeing why, after the world has shown that they could come up with a vaccine so quickly, which is just unbelievable in the scheme of anything that's ever happened before. And now the bureaucracy to get it into people's arms is so great. It's just something that it's really hard for me to process. And I think the longer it takes, the longer it's going to take for us to get the economy back to normal. But once we get through this and we do get vaccinated, I believe that there's going to be huge pent-up demand to get out, spend money. It's going to be great for the economy. It's going to be great for employment. A lot of this is going to, it's going to be really important that the schools open. And I, for one, if I learned something, never realized how important school was, because kids have to be able to go to school. A lot of them eat at the school, breakfast and lunch, and the school takes care of them so that their parents can work. And if the schools are closed, it makes it very difficult to do that. And schools are a very, very big business around the globe to help the economy to grow. So if we can get that going, then I think there are good things to come ahead in the economy and ahead in unemployment, especially for people like you who are in schools and ready to start your careers and entrepreneurs. I think this sped up a lot of technology that would have been brought on maybe a couple years later, like the Zoom video and the WebEx and Amazon and buying stuff at home and all the things that we knew are going to take time. That time frame has shortened, but the time frame to get there, unfortunately, has lengthened. So we're going to get there. It's hard to be patient because as we speak, there are a lot of people that are still suffering. This has been something that's created a lot of anxiety around the globe because it's a family issue. When one of your family members is sick, we still don't know enough about this to know the long-term effects of this. But it may be that we'll be taking a vaccine every year from now on, just like a flu vaccine. So what I'm indicating to you is the one thing that the markets and the economy and people don't handle well is uncertainty. And there's still a lot of uncertainty right now as we speak. This is causing a delay in many things, like people being able to save for retirement and retire in dignity. It's causing a delay in people energizing their careers and in building confidence for the next generation for the future. So the answer is, no matter what the situation is, I can assure you it's going to take longer. And we need to build that into our mindsets. And that's a hard thing to do when the next generation all wants things instantly. And so it will be an interesting environment to work through.
And that's the bottom line. Thanks so much for tuning in today. If you'd like to reach out to us, email us at hello@harvardventures.org and be sure to follow us on Instagram @Harvard_Ventures. Stay tuned next week for another episode of The Bottom Line.